In episode 1 and 2, we covered writers. Now, this podcast isn't Story of the Writers, it's Story of the Storytellers. I picked that name because I knew I would eventually want to cover some people who didn't really fit the category of author or writer. I want to tell the story of composers and painters and all kinds of interesting people throughout history. So today, we're going to mix things up. Let's start our story with a man. We'll call him David. David was born in Ireland in 1743, but would come to America in the 1750s. While here, David would find a home and a wife. He and his wife, Elizabeth Cairns, would live in Baltimore for the rest of their lives. When the British came a-taxing and the Americans came a-tea-dumping, David and his wife jumped at the chance to serve their country. During the American Revolution, David joined the army and worked as a quartermaster. A quartermaster, if you don't know, is basically in charge of acquiring and distributing supplies. Things like food, clothes, and ammunition. Things soldiers need to fight. Due to the chaos and disorganization of the Revolution, the American army wasn't always so good at supplying these supplies to their soldiers. However, David didn't let a little thing like that stop him. He loved this land he had made his home and was willing to do whatever he could to support it. So he would often just buy the supplies out of his own pocket. It's estimated that David spent close to $40,000 of his own money on the war effort. If you plug that figure into one of those dubious internet calculators, it'll tell you that that is roughly the equivalent of $1.5 million in today's money. Now, I find this number questionable and suspect the economic chaos of the revolution would require a more complicated calculation. That being said, I don't have a better number or a better calculator, so just take the 1.5 million number with a grain of salt. Whatever the real figure is, it was a lot of money. As you might expect, these purchases made David very popular with his unit. It also made him very close to the Marquis de Lafayette, who years later on a trip to Baltimore would tell anyone who would listen about David, the man who had given him $500 out of his own pocket to clothe Lafayette's troops, and David's wife Elizabeth, who had sewn 500 pairs of pants for the troops. If, after all this, you still doubt David's patriotism, consider this. The War of 1812 came to Baltimore in 1814. In what is now known as the Battle of Baltimore, Francis Scott Key would write Defense of Fort McHenry. The first stanza would later be plucked out, put to music, and be renamed as the Star-Spangled Banner. You may know it as America's National Anthem. Francis Scott Key was famously inspired by the large American flag that survived a particularly nasty bombardment by British ships. If he looked under the flag at the men who fought there, he may have seen a 71-year-old David proudly defending his country once again. When America needed help, David answered time and time again. David and Elizabeth would go on to have many children together. If that seems vague, good. It's meant to. To give you an idea of what level of information I'm working with when talking about David and his family, I've seen up to 7 children attributed to him and his wife. Out of the 7, only one has a confirmed death date. David himself doesn't even have a Wikipedia page. That's the level of historical obscurity I'm taking us into. David may not have a Wikipedia page, but what he does have is a son named David. We'll call him David Jr. He was born in 1784, and his family wants him to grow up and be a lawyer. Well, that sounds like it might take a lot of studying, so we'll give David and David Jr. some time to hit the books while we talk about the Charleston Comedians. The Charleston Comedians were a traveling theater troupe assembled by the mysterious Mr. Edgar. The troupe contained 2 people relevant to our interests, Elizabeth Arnold and Elizabeth Arnold. They were mother and daughter and had come over from England in 1796. And for clarity, I'm going to call the younger Elizabeth Arnold Eliza from here on in. Eliza was just 9 years old when she came to America, but she was already receiving very positive reviews for her acting and her singing. The older Elizabeth Arnold would marry musician Crockett Tubbs, and the troupe would tour around the northeast of America, performing plays and farces in whatever hall would book them. In 1798, while traveling through North Carolina, Eliza's mother, Elizabeth Arnold, died. If I'd known she was going to be out of the story so quickly, I wouldn't have given Eliza a nickname. Oh well, Eliza suits her anyway. In 1802, Eliza, now 15, would marry Charles Hopkins. 3 years later, Eliza would become a teenage widow as Charles died of yellow fever. The life of a traveling performer is rocky at the best of times, but Eliza seems to be having a particularly rough time with it. Around this time, Eliza and her troupe were performing in Virginia. David Jr., son of our protagonist from earlier, was in attendance. He was so blown away by Eliza's performance, he abandoned his family's plan for him and ran off to join her troupe. By 1806, the two would be married and traveling and performing throughout New England. Eliza continued to receive very positive reviews for her work. David Jr. was less popular and often criticized for his stage fright. David Jr. did what most performers do when confronted with bad reviews. He drank heavily. In 1807, the couple had their first child, William. Thank God they didn't call him David. I don't know how I'd juggle three Davids in this story. William would abandon his William early and would go by his middle name, Henry. 2 years later, on January 19th, 1809, their second son was born in Boston. They name him Edgar after the mysterious Mr. Edgar, who had managed Eliza's first troupe. Just to be different from his brother, he'll keep his Edgar and abandon whatever middle name they give him. In the summer of 1809, David Jr. had enough. He was sick of getting poor reviews, and he was sick of being a father. So he left acting, his family, and the gaze of history. Our knowledge of David Jr. ends with his departure in the summer of 1809. His family will later claim he died sometime in 1811, but this is heavily disputed. David Jr. is not the one child of David we have a confirmed death date for. Eliza kept on performing and giving birth, having her third and final child in December of 1810. Every member of Eliza and David's family will claim the father of this daughter, Rosalie, was David Jr. If that's true, he must have returned to his family after his departure, since there are more than 9 months between his departure and the birth of Rosalie. 1811 saw Eliza performing in Virginia when she started to cough up blood. By October, she had stopped performing and was bedridden. Members of the Richmond performing scene held a benefit performance for her in the Richmond Theater in November. Eliza would pass away December 8th, 1811. She was just 24. Not content with this singular tragedy, fans of theater in Virginia would soon suffer even more. 3 weeks after Eliza's death, the Richmond Theater, the same theater that had held a benefit for Eliza, would burn to the ground, killing 72 people, including the governor of Virginia, George William Smith. The fire, while tragic, also demonstrated the potential for human greatness and self-sacrifice, perhaps most notably from Gilbert Hunt, a former slave who is now working as the local blacksmith, and Dr. James McCaw, who worked together to save many lives. Dr. McCaw would lower people from the second story, and Hunt would catch them on the ground. Dr. McCaw definitely drew the short straw here by having to be the one in the building, but Gilbert Hunt made it up to him by catching Dr. McCaw when he jumped, shortly before a wall collapsed on him. Too often, we only remember and idolize criminals and monsters and victims. So despite this taking us away from our story, I wanted to take a few moments to remember the heroic work of Gilbert Hunt and Dr. James McCaw. After Eliza's death, Her children needed new homes. Henry would live with his grandfather David in Baltimore. Rosalie would be adopted by William and Jane Mackenzie in Virginia. Edgar was given to John and Frances Allen. While he was never adopted by the couple, he would take their last name as his middle name and keep his biological parents' last name. And so, from this tragedy so early in his life, America's uncrowned king of tragedy was given a name. The name belonged to the Anton Ego of the early American literary world, the father of both detective and weird fiction, a pioneer in science, both real and fictional, and the winner of an epic rap battle of history against Stephen King. H.P. Lovecraft would call this man his god of fiction. Noted plum eater William Carlos Williams once said, quote, "In him, American literature is anchored, in him alone, on solid ground." The man himself would grow up to say, "I have great faith in fools. Self-confidence, my friends will call it. Ladies, gentlemen, and everything in between, it's my absolute pleasure to introduce you to Edgar Allan Poe." Okay, I know that probably wasn't a very big shock. The episode will have Edgar Allan Poe in the title, after all. I just wanted to have a little fun. Now for a quick cleanup moment here before we begin. Our David was David Poe. David Jr. is David Poe Jr. And when I said we weren't covering a writer this time, I lied. We're still covering a writer. Although that whole, "I also want to cover people who aren't authors or writers," is 100% true. We will tackle some non-writers eventually, just not today. Edgar Allan Poe was taken in by Virginia tobacco merchant John Allen and his wife Frances in 1812, promising David Poe that they would provide Edgar with a good education. In 1815, John gets a tip that the United Kingdom desperately wants tobacco, so he moves the family to the UK for a few years to sell off his stock. While in the UK, Allen sends Poe to a grammar school in Scotland in 1815. In 1816, Edgar joins the rest of his family in London and studies at a boarding school just outside of London for about a year. Between 1817 and 1820, Poe would study in the home of John Bransby. John Bransby was a well-educated minister who was a member of countless societies, including the Linnean Society, which focused on natural history, the Geological Society, the Cambridge Philosophical Society, the Society of Antiquaries, and the Society for the Propagation of the Gospel in Foreign Parts. Okay, so he was in five societies. Not quite as countless as it first seemed, but that's still a lot. Bransby would lecture at St. Mary's Church, and in his free time, he opened his home in Stoke Newington to students. He would teach what modern educators call the classics. This included things like Latin, French, and poetry. Some Poe biographers credit Bransby with inspiring Poe's love of language and poetry during these years. A few decades later, Poe would include a version of Bransby in his somewhat autobiographical story, William Wilson. A few decades after that, another student of Bransby, William Hunter, recalled asking Bransby about Poe when he was a student, and was told Poe, and I quote, "was a quick and clever boy, and would have been a very good boy if he had not been spoiled by his parents. But they spoiled him, and allowed him an extravagant amount of pocket money, which enabled him to get into all manner of mischief." He would also say that Poe was intelligent, wayward, and willful. We don't know much about William Hunter, so it's hard to say if this quote is credible or not. I can tell you that the quote at least sounds like it came from a teacher. In 1820, John, Francis, and Edgar left the UK and returned to Virginia. Poe was around 11 when they returned. We know Edgar returned to Virginia in 1820, and we know he began college in 1826. we don't really know much about the details in between. For example, we know he continued his education, but I was unable to find any details about where or how. So while we don't know too much about this time, I want to cover three things. Number one, in 1824, Edgar Allan Poe served as the lieutenant of the Richmond Youth Honor Guard for a visit from the Marquis de Lafayette. This is the visit I talked about when we covered David Poe Sr. earlier. David Poe Sr. had died in 1816, but his widow Elizabeth was still alive and had a very pleasant reunion with Lafayette, who told everyone he could find about how David and Elizabeth had helped him and his soldiers by buying and sewing them clothes. Number two, in 1825, John Allen's uncle died and left John an inheritance of roughly $750,000. Using our handy-dandy internet calculator again, it's roughly the equivalent of $23 million today. With his newfound wealth, John buys a house called Moldavia. First of all, I don't know why the house has a name. I think it's a rich person thing. Secondly, I didn't know why the house was named after a Central European state, so I did a little digging. Turns out, it's not named after the Central European state. It's named after the original builders, Molly and David Meade Randolph. They took the Mall from Molly and the Davy from David and smashed them together to make Moldavia. Now that I know that, I kinda hate it, to be honest. We know John paid roughly $15,000 for it, if that gives you a better idea of how much the $750,000 he inherited was worth. Third, throughout his time in Virginia, Edgar Allan Poe would keep in regular contact with his brother and sister. He would write letters to Henry, who lived in Baltimore, and would often visit Rosalie at her school and read poems to her and her classmates. At some point in this time frame, Henry would visit Edgar in Richmond and was introduced to Sarah Elmira Royster. Sarah Royster was a neighbor of Poe's and was his childhood crush. Henry would later write about Edgar and Sarah's romance in his short story, The Pirate. Edgar and Sarah were in love. In fact, around 1826, it's suspected the two got secretly engaged. When Sarah's father discovered this, he was furious. I already mentioned that Poe will go to college in 1826. While there, he will only be able to communicate with Sarah via letters. Sarah's father, once he discovered the secret romance and possible engagement, began to do everything he could to stop the letters from reaching Sarah, usually by intercepting and burning them before she could read them. Believing that Poe had abandoned her, Sarah will move on with her life. Believing that Sarah has abandoned him, Poe will drink a lot. Anyway, back to our regularly scheduled chronological advance. In February of 1826, Poe is 17, possibly engaged, and off to college. He decided to enroll in the University of Virginia. The University of Virginia was rather new. It had just opened in 1825, and the original board of directors included three former U.S. presidents, Jefferson, Madison, and Monroe, and the current U.S. Supreme Court Chief Justice, John Marshall. If you're a big Supreme Court fan, you may know John Marshall as the Chief Justice who presided over Marbury v. Madison, which solidified the Supreme Court's power of judicial review, which allows the court to strike down laws if they're deemed unconstitutional. Most universities at the time only offered three majors: medicine, law, and divinity. The University of Virginia offered eight: medicine, law, mathematics, chemistry, ancient languages, modern languages, natural philosophy, and moral philosophy, or as I like to call it, unnatural philosophy. Poe enrolled with the intention to study ancient and modern languages. Poe would study at the University of Virginia for only 1 year. During that year, we already know his relationship with his girlfriend/fiancé fell apart due to her father's interference. Poe's relationship with John Allen also fell apart. Poe did not feel like John had given him enough money to pay for classes and a place to stay. John felt that he had given Poe plenty of money to do those things, but that Poe had blown his money on alcohol and gambling. A classic disagreement, I suspect, is occurring right now across the country at just about every university. Despite excelling academically, Poe would drop out in 1827 due to financial issues. What was he to do? His girlfriend wouldn't write him back, and he was fighting with his family. That meant he couldn't return to Virginia. So in April 1827, at the age of 18, Poe heads to Boston. He gets odd jobs working as a clerk and a newspaper writer. A few months later, a poetry collection called Tamerlane and Other Poems is published, with the author simply credited as a Bostonian. Careful analysis of this work has determined that the author of these poems was one Edgar A. Perry, a 22-year-old private in the U.S. Army. 50 copies were printed, and the collection receives absolutely no fanfare. Less than a year after Perry's death, a prominent literature critic will claim the collection never existed and challenges someone to produce one. It takes over a decade after this challenge for the first copy to be found, finally proving the existence of this book. We only know of 12 that exist today. The poems inside are not considered to be anything too special and are criticized for the obvious immaturity of the author. A few people think that Perry might do better as he gets older and keeps at his craft. Now I know what you're thinking. Edgar A. Perry must actually be Poe under a barely disguised name. But that can't be. Poe is 18. Perry is 22. He said so in his application to be in the army. It's not like Poe could just lie to the army, right? Well, it turns out he could, and you're 100% right. Edgar A. Perry is, in fact, Edgar Allan Poe. He first served at Fort Independence in Boston Harbor and made $5 a month. Not amazing, but it keeps him off the streets. Later that year, Poe's regiment is reassigned to Fort Moultrie in South Carolina. At Fort Moultrie, Poe was promoted and had his pay doubled. So his book of poems didn't do too well, but at least he's doing well in the army. In fact, Poe would serve another 2 years and be promoted to the rank of Sergeant Major for Artillery, the highest rank he could achieve as a non-commissioned officer. Poe had originally signed on for 5 years, but after about 2 years with no real prospect for advancement, he wanted out. He tells his commanding officer that he lied when he applied and wants to be discharged so he can enroll in West Point and continue his career as a military man. His commanding officer tells him he will let Poe out, but Poe first has to reconcile with John Allen, and that just seems wild to me. Imagine trying to quit your job, and your boss says you can only quit if you patch up your relationship with your parents. Poe writes letter after letter to Allen, who largely ignores him until February of 1829. Frances Allen, John's wife, passes away at the end of the month, which softens John's heart. Poe is allowed to visit home the day after Frances is buried and reconciles at least a little with John, who finally supports Poe's attempt to leave the army. So, on April 15th, 1829, Edgar Allan Poe is discharged. Before heading to West Point, Poe moves to Baltimore for a few months to live with his aunt, Maria Clemm, his first cousin, Virginia Clemm, his brother Henry, and his grandmother Elizabeth. This is Poe's first time living with blood relatives since his mother died when he was 2 years old. He's 20 now. During this time, Poe finishes some poems and puts them together in a collection called Al-Araf, Tamerlane, and Minor Poems. He sends an advanced copy to John Neal, a prominent critic of the time. Neal gives Poe, in Poe's own words, the very first words of encouragement I ever remember to have heard. Wouldn't it be cool if we knew what those words were? Well, it turns out we do. Neal wrote, He will deserve to stand high, very high, in the estimation of the Shining Brotherhood. Whether he will do so, however, must depend not so much upon his words now in mere poetry, as upon his worth hereafter in something yet loftier and more generous. We allude to the stronger properties of the mind, to the magnanimous determination that enables a youth to endure the present, whatever the present may be, in the hope, or rather in the belief, the fixed, unwavering belief, that in the future he will find his reward. Neal later concludes that Poe, and I quote, might make a beautiful and perhaps magnificent poem. There is a good deal here to justify such a hope. With those words bolstering him, Poe publishes Alaraf, Tamerlane, and Minor Poems under his own name. It receives pretty mixed reviews, but mixed reviews are better than what he got for his first collection. Our boy is moving up in the world. And true to his word, Edgar Allan Poe joins West Point, July 1st, 1830, as a cadet. He is well-liked by his fellow cadets, mostly for the sarcastic and satirical poems he writes about their instructors. In October of that year, John Allan remarried. He would marry Louisa Patterson. This marriage would be the final straw between John and Edgar. John writes Poe a letter, severing all ties with him. We don't have this letter today, just Poe's response, which said, "Sir, I suppose, although you desire no further communication with yourself on my part, that your restriction does not extend to my answering your final letter. Did I, when an infant, solicit your charity and protection, or was it of your own free will that you volunteered your services in my behalf? It is well known to respectable individuals in Baltimore and elsewhere, that my grandfather, my natural protector at the time you interposed, was wealthy, and that I was his favorite grandchild. But the promises of adoption and liberal education, which you held forth to him in a letter which is now in possession of my family, induced him to resign all care of me into your hands. Under such circumstances, can it be said that I have no right to expect anything at your hands? You may probably urge that you have given me a liberal education. I will leave the decision of that question to those who know how far liberal educations can be obtained in 8 months at the University of Virginia. Here you will say that it is my own fault that I did not return. You would not let me return because bills were presented to you for payment which I never wished nor desired you to pay. Had you let me return, my reformation had been sure, as my conduct the last 3 months gave every reason to believe, and you would never have heard more of my extravagances. But I am not about to proclaim myself guilty of all that has been alleged against me, and which I have hitherto endured, simply because I was too proud to reply. I will boldly say that it was wholly and entirely your own mistaken parsimony that caused all the difficulties in which I was involved while at Charlottesville." And no. It's not just you. The letter kinda reads like a spoiled teen wrote it. Edgar takes responsibility for nothing and shifts the blame entirely away from himself. His critics have attacked his poetry for being too immature. They may not have been wrong. A month after Poe wrote this letter, he got himself intentionally court-martialed and left West Point in February 1831 at the age of 22. He had taken a collection from his classmates before he left and raised about $170, which he used to go to New York and publish a book of poems simply called Poems. After that, he returned to Baltimore to live with his aunt, cousin, brother, and grandmother. Now, I don't want to dive too deeply into these poems, but there are some things to mention. First of all, if you look at the Wikipedia pages of just about all of the poems and poems, you'll see some form of inspired by Samuel Taylor Coleridge. Poe is a huge Coleridge fan. And while I don't want to do any real analysis of the poems, there are two poems I want to talk about in particular. The first is The Sleeper. Later in his life, Poe would write in a letter that The Sleeper, and I quote, is better than the raven, but there is not one man in a million who could be brought to agree with me in this opinion. Now, I am not one man in a million, as I also prefer the raven, but I thought I'd call out the sleeper for Edgar. The second poem I want to talk about is Israfel. Israfel is about an angel from the Quran who has a trumpet for a voice and is said to have the sweetest voice of all God's creatures. Leonard Bernstein, noted composer and creator of West Side Story, would set Israfel to music in 1977 as part of Songfest, a collection of American poems set to music. If you don't mind, I'd like to quote the ending of Israfel for you here. I don't have any notes, I just think it's beautiful. Yes, heaven is thine, but this is a world of sweets and sours. Our flowers are merely flowers, and the shadow of thy perfect bliss is the sunshine of ours. If I could dwell where Israfel hath dwelt, and he where I, he might not sing so wildly well a mortal melody, while a bolder note than this might swell from my lyre within the sky. While Poe celebrates his new release, I'd like to take a moment to talk about Henry Poe, Edgar's brother. Henry has not been idle while his brother has been writing and serving in the army. Henry himself had joined the Navy and sailed on the USS Macedonian. The Macedonian was a British ship that had been captured during the War of 1812. Now, in American hands, it traveled the world with Henry on board. While serving, he saw South America, the West Indies, the Mediterranean, and even Russia. He would return to Baltimore in 1827 and work at a law office. At some point, Henry started writing and reciting poetry, largely inspired by Lord Byron. It's hard to determine what Henry actually wrote, as Edgar used to mail him poems to publish while Edgar was in the army, and some historians have incorrectly attributed some of those poems to Henry. Because of this confusion, it's hard to definitively state that Henry wrote this and Edgar wrote that. Writer Frederick William Thomas met Henry in 1828 when Henry was 21 and offered one of the only descriptions we have of Henry. I was intimate with Poe's brother in Baltimore during the year 1828. He was a slim, feeble young man with dark, inexpressive eyes, and his forehead had nothing like the expansion of his brother's. His manners were fastidious. We visited lady acquaintances together, and he wrote Byron poetry in albums, which had little originality. He recited in private, and was proud of his oratorical powers. In 1831, a few months after Poe returned from West Point, Henry contracted tuberculosis, the disease that had killed his mother, and would die before his 25th birthday. As one final insult, his obituary misspelled his name as W.H. Hope instead of W.H. Poe. So Poe has lost his mother, his father, his brother, his childhood sweetheart, his relationship with his father figure, and is currently unemployed after leaving West Point. So what does he do? He decides to try to make money as a writer. Which is a horrible idea. Not because he lacks talent or ability, but because America does not have international copyright laws. Now, I'm not going to bore you with the nitty-gritty of copyright law, but basically, American publishers at this time could just publish works from British authors without paying them. It was a little shady, but they could do it, which means not many publishers wanted to pay for stories. Poe does manage to get a few of his stories published in this time frame. And no, I didn't misspeak. Poe has moved on from poetry to prose. He's left that boring old poetry behind because he thinks prose will pay better. He'll jump back and forth between poetry and prose throughout his life. And by 1833, things are not looking well for Poe. He's broke and is not succeeding on his own. His main source of income is earned by begging on the street. He is so desperate, in fact, he writes a letter to John Allen. It has now been more than 2 years since you have assisted me, and more than 3 since you have spoken to me. I feel little hope that you will pay any regard to this letter, but still, I cannot refrain from making one more attempt to interest you in my behalf. If you will only consider in what a situation I am placed, you will surely pity me. Without friends, without any means, consequently, of obtaining employment, I am perishing, absolutely perishing for want of aid. And yet, I am not idle, nor addicted to any vice, nor have I committed any offense against society which would render me deserving of so hard a fate. For God's sake, pity me, and save me from destruction. A few months later, still broke and destitute, Poe enters his story, MS Found in a Bottle, to a contest in the Baltimore Saturday Visitor. The contest promised $50 and publication in the October 19th issue for first place. As you may have guessed, Poe won. The $50 helped, no doubt, but more importantly, it caught the eye of John P. Kennedy. John P. Kennedy was a powerful man, and he used his connections to get Poe published in more places, as well as introduce him to Thomas Willis White, printer and publisher of the Southern Literary Messenger, a Richmond-based periodical. Poe would submit several stories of his to the Southern Literary Messenger, including the short story Berenice. Berenice especially garnered some public outcry due to its more macabre themes and intense violence. After it was published, Poe wrote a letter to White saying, "The history of all magazines shows plainly that those which have attained celebrity were indebted for it to articles similar in nature to Berenice. Although I grant you far superior in style and execution, I say similar in nature. You ask me, in what does this nature consist? In the ludicrous, heightened into the grotesque. The fearful, colored into the horrible. The witty, exaggerated into the burlesque. The singular, wrought out into the strange and mystical. You may say all this is bad taste. I have my doubts about it. Nobody is more aware than I am that simplicity is the cant of the day. But take my word for it, no one cares anything about simplicity in their hearts. Believe me also, in spite of what people say to the contrary, that there is nothing easier in the world than to be extremely simple. But whether the articles of which I speak are, or are not, in bad taste, is little to the purpose. To be appreciated, you must be read, and these things are invariably sought after with avidity." A couple clarifications for those of us not living in the 1800s. Avidity is defined by Merriam-Webster as keen eagerness or consuming greed. For those of you confused by cant of the day, I can shed a little light. Cant, in this context, is not used a lot today. This is C-A-N-T, no apostrophe. You may recognize cant from the D&D ability, Thieves' Cant, which is a secret way of communicating used by rogues and thieves. That's a different cant. Cant of the day, as far as I can tell, is used here to basically mean flavor of the month. Poe is saying that it's popular to say you want simplicity right now, but it's not what people actually want. Similar to people saying they're sick of seeing politics talked about online, despite the fact that they constantly click and engage with any and all political content they find. White must have liked what Poe was saying because he hired Poe to be the assistant editor. Poe's job would be to publish poems and stories, write book reviews and critiques, and edit the magazine as a whole. This job went really well for Poe. For about 2 weeks, he was fired almost immediately for being drunk on the job. After being fired, Poe left Richmond and returned to Baltimore. While there, he promised to marry Virginia Clem, his 13-year-old cousin. Which is gross. He was 26 at the time. Which is grosser. No real sugarcoating it. White would rehire Poe shortly after firing him, under the condition that Poe promised to be well-behaved. Poe pinky promised and returned to Virginia to work at the Messenger. He took his aunt and his cousin with him. May 16th, 1836. Edgar Allan Poe marries Virginia Eliza Clem. The wedding is performed by Amasa Converse, a preacher who had mostly left the pulpit at this point to be a publisher and an editor. He thought Virginia looked pretty young, but the family provided a witness who claimed she was 21. The witness may have been Thomas Cleland, another preacher-turned-writer and publisher, but I wasn't able to definitively confirm that. Poe would work at the Messenger till January 1837. He would later claim that under his tenure as editor, the Messenger increased its copies sold from 700 to 3,500. But we only really have his word for it. What we know for sure is that Poe begins to establish a reputation while working at the Southern Literary Messenger. You and I know Poe's real legacy is his creative work. People at the time, however, viewed Poe as a critic first and a writer second. Poe was known to be a fearless critic who was more than happy to be harsh when he needed to be harsh. It was not uncommon for people to suggest that Poe wrote not with ink, but with acid. Because of this, William Carlos Williams would later say of Poe the critic, quote, "Poe gives the sense for the first time in America that literature is serious, not a matter of courtesy, but of truth." In 1838, Poe leaves Richmond and moves to Philadelphia. Also in 1838, Poe publishes his only completed novel, The Narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym of Nantucket. The Narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym of Nantucket was, first and foremost, a failure for Poe. He had spent a long time writing it in hopes that it would make him money. It didn't. It was largely a commercial failure and wasn't really that well received by contemporary critics who didn't like how violent it was and criticized Poe for plagiarizing chunks of it from explorer J.N. Reynolds. The novel starts out as a pretty basic adventure and exploration story. Poe used his own experience sailing to and from England as a kid, as well as stories his brother Henry told him about his time on the USS Macedonian, to portray the sailing elements of the story. By the end of the novel, it's a little less basic and starts to incorporate some weirder elements. And then it just ends, with a human-like figure showing up shrouded all in white, causing massive debates about what the ending really means. So it wasn't an immediate success, but it would find its purchase as a major influence for other novelists, most notably Herman Melville and Jules Verne. Some scholars believe that Melville's Moby Dick was heavily inspired by Poe's Pym. Jules Verne, author of Around the World in 80 Days, openly admitted his Poe influence. He wrote essays analyzing Poe's works and would publish a sequel to Pym called An Antarctic Mystery. Shortly after the publication of Pym, Poe returns to his editing work. He is hired on as the assistant editor of Burton's Gentleman's Magazine and continued to build his reputation as one of the best literary critics in America. In 1839, my personal favorite Poe story, The Fall of the House of Usher, is published in Burton's Gentleman's Magazine. It's relatively popular and inspires Poe to release Tales of the Grotesque and Arabesque, which is a collection of short stories that is relatively unpopular. It sells so poorly that publishers refuse to give Poe a second printing when he asks for one. It does provide us with a good Poe quote from the intro, though. Critics had criticized Poe for being too Germanic, since Germany was associated at the time with horror. Poe responded by saying, quote, If in many of my productions terror has been the thesis, I maintain that terror is not of Germany, but of the soul, that I have deduced the terror only from its legitimate sources and urged it only to its legitimate results. 1840 is the beginning of Poe's final quest. He is 31 and one of, if not the most well-known and well-respected literary critics in America. He has made publishers and printers a lot of money, but he still struggles with debt. The solution comes shortly after he leaves Burton's with an advertisement he places in June of 1840. The advertisement reads, "Prospectus of the Penn Magazine, a monthly literary journal to be edited and published in the city of Philadelphia by Edgar A. Poe." Realizing there's more money in owning than in working, Poe decides to start his own magazine. Despite the advertisement garnering significant interest in the literary world, Poe does not start the Penn right away. Instead, he meets George Graham. Graham had recently started his own magazine, simply called Graham's Magazine, and hires Poe to be his editor. Graham promises Poe that he'll financially support him when he leaves to start his own publication. In the meantime, though, he pays Poe $800 a year to be his editor, which is quite a bit of money. Graham's magazine would regularly feature news stories from Poe, including The Murders in the Rue Morgue in 1841. This story saw the first appearance of Poe's character, C. Auguste Dupin, the first detective in American fiction. In fact, Dupin was arguably the first detective in America. Our idea of what a detective is had only really appeared in the last decade. The first private detective agency was founded in 1833 in France. America didn't see their first detective unit until 1846, 5 years after Dupin's first appearance. Arthur Conan Doyle references Dupin in the first Sherlock Holmes book. Doyle was a huge fan of Poe and credits him with basically creating the genre of detective fiction. Agatha Christie also pulled heavily from Dupin for her character, Hercule Poirot. Poe's influence on the genre is still honored by the Mystery Writers of America, who call their yearly awards the Edgars. The Murders in the Rue Morgue brings up a problem with trying to tell the story of Poe in a relatively quick and simple way, for seemingly every work you look even a little way into, you'll see the vast web of influence it has cast over the literary world. I told you earlier that William Carlos Williams said of Poe that, quote, "In him, American literature is anchored, in him alone, on solid ground." He wasn't kidding. He's the father of the detective genre. He's also the father of the genre of weird fiction. Weird fiction is a term popularized by H.P. Lovecraft to describe the genre of horror that replaces your traditional horror monsters like the vampire or the werewolf with cosmic, unexplainable monstrosities that usually involve tentacles for some reason. Poe is credited as being the first real weird fiction writer, even though the genre wouldn't really be acknowledged till after Poe's eventual death. And that's not even the extent of Poe's groundbreaking work. Just know that while I'm doing my best to cover the main ones, there are more groundbreaking, influential works than I could possibly cover. This podcast is basically a Lit 101 class. If you want to learn about the rest of them, you're going to have to find a Lit 201 podcast. Poe would leave Graham's Magazine in April of 1842. Though he would continue to contribute stories and poems to the magazine. Poe had been unhappy for a while with how much he was being paid. He'd been thrilled at the start, but seeing how much profit Graham was making as the owner had caused a rift. Poe again realized that he wasn't going to get rich just by working at a magazine. He needed to own one. Poe was replaced by Rufus Griswold, who is kind of Poe's arch-nemesis? As a further slight to Poe, Griswold is paid $1,000 a year, 200 more than Poe was. Despite this, Graham's readers were unhappy. They had enjoyed Poe's work, and Griswold was not Poe. Because of this, Graham offered Poe his old job back 5 months after he left. Poe refused. He was on to new pastures. In early 1843, Poe signed a contract with popular illustrator Felix Octavius Carr Darley, commonly known simply as FOC Darley. This contract was through July 1st, 1844, and was for 3 to 5 illustrations a month for use in Poe's upcoming magazine, The Stylus. One of the most surprising parts of this story for me was learning that stylus is not a modern word or concept. The first use of a stylus, in fact, was for cuneiform, which is the oldest system of writing in history. Poe chose the name as kind of an inside joke. His magazine was originally going to be called The Pen because it was based in Pennsylvania and a pen is a writing utensil. Renaming the magazine to The Stylus, another writing utensil, was Poe's little joke. Darley was contracted to work for The Stylus, but he would never do a single illustration for the publication. He did, however, illustrate Poe's newest story, The Gold Bug. The Gold Bug was entered into the Philadelphia Dollar newspaper's writing contest and won the grand prize of $100, a huge boon for Poe. The Gold Bug was massively popular and was probably the most read piece of fiction Poe had ever written at the time. The main thing I want to talk about with The Gold Bug is its use of cryptography. Cryptography is the use of ciphers and codes to communicate. If you ask one of your cryptographer friends, they'll tell you that Poe was not very gifted in cryptography. He only ever really dabbled with pretty simple versions of it. If you asked Poe, he'd probably tell you the same thing. He knew he wasn't very good. He also knew he was better at it than the average reader. So he held contests in the magazines and newspapers he edited and would solve cryptograms his readers sent in. The Gold Bug, Poe's popular story, revolves around a cryptogram and ciphers. Both of these things helped to make cryptography very popular in Poe's time. This is also an instance of Poe's wide-reaching influence on history. William Friedman, the American cryptologist who deciphered Japan's purple code in World War II, first became interested in cryptography after reading The Gold Bug as a child. In 1844, at the age of 35, Poe wrote to James Russell Lowell about starting The Stylus. Charles Briggs, another author, also wrote to Lowell in 1844 about starting his own newspaper called the Broadway Journal. Briggs, unlike Poe, partnered with John Briscoe and followed through on his promise, publishing the first issue in January of 1845. Also in January of 1845, a little poem called The Raven was published for the first time. It was instantly popular and gave Poe more recognition than anything else he had ever done. That being said, due to some complicated contract stuff we're just going to gloss over, it didn't really make him much money. Poe became an overnight superstar in status, but was still financially struggling. A month later, Briggs signed Poe to a year-long contract to work at the Broadway Journal. In exchange for being the editor and providing one page of original material per week, Poe would receive 1/3 of the profits. Our boy is finally going to reap the rewards of ownership. Unfortunately, the paper didn't do very well. Briggs believed the issue was Poe's reputation for harsh criticism, and wanted to buy him and Biscoe, his original partner, out. Biscoe asked for more money than Briggs would pay, and while Poe considered selling for a while, he never really followed through with it. So in June of that year, Briggs simply quit. In October, Biscoe sold his share to Poe for $50. Now, Poe owns it all. The only issue is that the paper is simply not profitable. But Poe takes a loan in October to keep him going as he tries to make it work. Poe would try many things in the following months to make his paper more popular. He tries publishing his own work. He continues his work as a critic. He publicly flirts with poet Francis Sargent Osgood. None of this really helps the profitability of his paper, so he tries something new. He calls out poet Henry Longfellow and accuses him of plagiarism. There is some doubt today as to whether this call out is a real critique of Longfellow or just a publicity stunt. William Carlos Williams, a name I'm going to keep bringing up because I just love his chapter on Poe in The American Grain, paints Poe as the first real American writer. While other writers were trying to be British or French writers who just happened to live in America, Poe was trying to be an American writer. Williams describes Longfellow and Poe as both trying to bring culture to America, though Longfellow was trying to import it, while Poe was trying to cultivate and create it. Williams summarizes it by saying, and I quote, "Poe conceived the possibility, the sullen, volcanic inevitability of the place. He was willing to go down and wrestle with its conditions, using every tool France, England, Greece could give him, but to use them to original purpose. This is his anger against Longfellow." Williams would also say of Poe, and I quote, "He was American. He was the astounding, inconceivable growth of his locality." When I first read those words, I couldn't help but think of David Poe Sr., a man who came to America and stood up to defend it at every possible moment. He fought for his grandson's right to wrestle with the conditions of this new world. None of Poe's stunts worked, and in January 1846, the Broadway Journal published its final issue. Poe got his first real taste of ownership and failed to make it popular. That being said, for a large chunk of the paper's life, he'd only ever been a partial owner. He still holds on to the hope that a paper or magazine owned solely by Poe will be successful. You may have noticed that I just slipped into an earlier section a line about Poe flirting with a poet. You may have found that quite strange, considering Poe was married. Well, it is a little strange, and a little sad. Virginia, Poe's wife, contracted tuberculosis in 1842. As she suffered from this disease, she would go from feeling relatively well to being a complete invalid. These constant shifts caused Edgar significant mental strain. In a letter around this time, Poe gave us one of his most famous quotes as he described his emotional state. "Each time I felt all the agonies of her death, and at each accession of the disorder, I loved her more dearly and clung to her life with more desperate pertinacity. But I am constitutionally sensitive, nervous in a very unusual degree. I became insane with long intervals of horrible sanity." By 1846, Virginia openly admitted that she knew she would die soon. It's thought by some she accepted and even encouraged Edgar's flirtations with Francis Osgood, as it offered him comfort, and she wanted him to be taken care of after she died. After the failure of the Broadway Journal, Poe wrote the only letter to his wife that has survived to this day. In it, he said, "Keep up your heart in all hopefulness and trust yet a little longer. In my last great disappointment, I should have lost my courage, but for you. My little darling wife, you are my greatest and only stimulus now to battle with this uncongenial, unsatisfactory, and ungrateful life." Scholars believe that the last great disappointment was the failure of the Broadway Journal. On January 30th, 1847, Virginia died at home. Eliza Poe, Edgar's mother, died of tuberculosis at the age of 24 when Poe was 2. Henry Poe, Edgar's brother, died of tuberculosis at the age of 24 when Poe was 22. Virginia, Edgar's beloved wife and cousin, died of tuberculosis at the age of 24 when Poe was 38. Poe could simply not escape the people he loved dying young. Virginia's long sickness and the early deaths of his mother and wife are often credited with Poe's consistent theme of young women dying early. The death of his wife hurt Poe immensely. He would visit her grave almost every night and sit beside it. While it hurt and Poe struggled with it, he also put into words the struggle of anyone who has watched a loved one go through a long illness. When talking about her death, Poe said, "This I can and do endure as becomes a man. It was the horrible, never-ending oscillation between hope and despair, which I could not longer have endured without the total loss of reason." After her death, Poe would try once again to get the stylus off the ground. In early 1848, Poe gave a combination fundraiser and lecture titled On the Cosmography of the Universe, which would later be published as Eureka, a Prose Poem. The lecture and poem seek to explain the origins of the universe. The fundraiser was largely a failure. Poe expected hundreds of attendees. About 60 showed up, and most of them were very confused. After publishing the poem, the critical reception was equally baffled. There are two main issues here. The first is that this entire lecture and poem may not have been serious. It has some kind of goofy parts and spends some time roasting previous thinkers and makes puns out of their name. The second issue is that this was a scientific lecture based not on logic or fact, but on intuition. Poe just kind of guessed at how the universe might have originated. Scientific minds have spent the time since Eureka's publication realizing just how many things Poe seemingly got right. By publishing Eureka, Poe became the first person to suggest the idea of what we know today as the Big Bang Theory on the origin of the universe, and the Big Crunch Theory on the end of the universe. Eureka also anticipates what we know today as black holes, and offers the first solution to Olber's paradox. Olber's paradox is that the night is full of bright stars, but it's still dark. When noted astronomer Edward Harrison published a solution to the paradox in his book Darkness at Night in 1987, he discovered that he was not the first person to suggest his solution. Eureka beat him to it by about 140 years. I know the origins of the universe are a controversial topic, but even if you reject the Big Bang Theory, you've got to be impressed that a depressed poet taking guesses at the origins of the universe has lined up reasonably well with scientific progression. And if it makes you feel better, Eureka got plenty of things wrong about science, which is not shocking. After all, it's just a poet taking guesses at the origins of the universe. At the time, Poe considered Eureka to be his magnum opus, even if he only made $14 from it. While traveling through Virginia in 1848, Poe decides to take a chance and stops by a local woman's house. He didn't make an appointment or write to her in advance. He just showed up. But when he is announced, the woman rushes down to greet him. And, for the first time in almost 20 years, Poe sees his first love, Sarah Royster. In the years since their secret engagement, Sarah had gotten married to wealthy businessman Alexander Shelton in 1828. They had 4 kids together, 2 of which survived to adulthood. Alexander died in 1844, leaving Sarah an estate of $100,000, roughly $4 million in today's money. As part of this inheritance, Sarah was not allowed to remarry. If she did, she would forfeit most of the money. So, for the last 4 years, she'd been living alone with her 19-year-old daughter Anne and her 10-year-old son Southall. Anne and Southall didn't like Poe, but Sarah did. She always had. Reunited, the two rekindle their relationship. Poe would visit Sarah frequently, and in 1849, he asked her to marry him. She told him that she needed more time, but by September, she had reached a decision. We don't know what the decision was, only that it was made. Poe leaves Richmond to head to Baltimore. Sarah describes seeing Poe the day before he left Richmond, and describes him as looking ill. On October 3rd, 1849, a few weeks after leaving Richmond, Poe would be found dead in Baltimore. He was 40 years old. The circumstances surrounding his death are unknown, but constantly speculated about. While I'm fascinated by a lot of literary history and its mysteries, Poe's death has never really done it for me. He died. While we don't know exactly why, that's not that uncommon for this time period. We don't know how his father or five of his aunts and uncles died either. If it's your things, there's a lot of books and podcasts about it that speculate his death came from voter fraud, alien abductions, poisoning, or even murder. If that's your thing, I encourage you to look into it. As for us, we have one final loose thread to resolve. Rosalie Poe. Edgar had visited Rosalie in 1849 during his trip to Richmond, where he proposed to Sarah. Following his death, Rosalie was technically Edgar's heir, but never officially signed the paperwork for it. While Poe had constantly written stories about women dying young and the men they left behind, Rosalie defied Poe's theme. She was an aging woman surrounded by dead men. Her brothers, Henry and Edgar, were dead. The Mackenzie family that had adopted her could no longer support her due to losing their money in the American Civil War. So, to survive, she traveled back and forth from Baltimore to Richmond, begging and selling photographs and mementos of her famous brother. She was eventually taken in by a church home in D.C., where she spent her final days until dying in 1874 at the age of 63. And so ends the family of Eliza and David Poe, Jr. In 1949, a bottle of cognac and three roses were left at Poe's grave marker on his birthday. In 1950, another bottle and another three roses. This happened year after year. The anonymous person became known as the Poe Toaster. Historian Sam Popora would later take credit for it, though his account is riddled with inaccuracies, and there's doubt about whether it was truly him. Regardless of who it was, this tradition continued until 2009, when the final bottle and roses were left on what would have been Poe's 200th birthday. Coincidentally, also in 2009, a young student was assigned The Fall of the House of Usher by his English teacher. He quickly fell in love with the writing and with Poe. The student had suffered from depression for a long time, and had already made a failed attempt on his life. Poe was the first person this student had ever seen admit they were depressed and still leave a mark on history. It's such a silly thing, but this was the moment the student understood why representation was so important. Seeing yourself in someone you admire is such a powerful thing. This would lead the student into a lifelong love affair with literature and poetry. And, in 2024, that student got the chance to share Poe with all of you, and it's been my absolute honor. I want to end this show with one of the final poems Poe got published. It's long been one of my absolute favorites. Take this kiss upon thy brow, and in parting from you now, thus much let me avow. You are not wrong who deem that my days have been a dream. Yet if hope has flown away in a night or in a day, in a vision or in none, is it therefore the less gone? All that we see or seem is but a dream within a dream. I stand amid the roar of a surf-tormented shore, and I hold within my hand grains of the golden sand. How few, yet how they creep through my fingers to the deep, while I weep, while I weep. O God, can I not grasp them with a tighter clasp? O God, can I not save one from the pitiless wave? Is all that we see or seem but a dream within a dream? Thank you all for listening. You may have noticed I did a few less pit stops to talk about other writers this time. That's because I honestly found so many interesting people while researching this, I couldn't fit them all in. So I'm thinking I might do a future episode of all the crazy fun lives I discovered while researching this show. Is that something you'd like to hear? Let me know. And if you have any other questions, comments, concerns, or suggestions for a storyteller for me to cover, feel free to reach out on Twitter at StoryOfStoryTLR. Or, if you've abandoned Twitter, which is completely reasonable, feel free to email me at storyofthestorytellers@gmail.com. Finally, to steal a quote from a pair of goofs, soupy twists.